off at gunpoint, while another party stormed into the wheelhouse to gain command of the ship. Bill Fry and five of his crew greeted the first three men who entered the wheelhouse with pistols and angry fists. Although he was completely cut off, Bill continued fighting until British Marines dragged him from the wheelhouse and beat him unconscious with clubs. After 4 hours of fighting, with eight of their men dead and a score wounded, the British gained control of the Promised Land. 15 Jews were killed. Among them, the American captain, Bill Fry. A general order for secrecy was issued at Haifa Harbor in Palestine as the Dunstan Hill towed the Promised Land in. The old steamship was listing badly. The entire Haifa dock area was flooded with British troops. The 6th Airborne Division was there, and they were armed to the teeth. But in their attempt at maintaining the secrecy, the British did not know that the Jews had broadcast a full account of the boarding of the Promised Land over their radio. As the ships approached Haifa Bay, the Jews in Palestine called a general strike. Troops and tanks were required in the dock area to form a barrier between the refugees and Palestine's angry Jews. 4 British prison ships, Empire Monitor, Empire Renown, Empire Guardian, and the Magna Carta, waited to effect an immediate transfer of the refugees from the Promised Land. But the very instant the Chesapeake Bay liner was towed into port, the harbor area and the entire city of Haifa shook under the impact of a mighty blast. The Empire Monitor was blown to pieces. This act was accomplished by Palmach frogmen who swam in and attached a magnetic mine to the ship's sides. The Promised Land docked, and the transfer operation began at once. Most of the refugees had had the fight knocked out of them. They went quietly to delousing sheds where they were stripped, sprayed, searched for weapons, and moved quickly onto the 3 remaining prison ships. It was a tragic procession. Dov Landau and 25 others locked themselves into a hold, armed themselves with pipes, and defied the British to the very end. The hold was pumped full of tear gas, and Dov was carried from the Promised Land by 4 soldiers, still struggling, cursing, and fighting. He was thrown into a barred cell on the Magna Carta. The prison ships were packed even more tightly than the Promised Land had been, and that same night they sailed from Haifa with the 2 cruisers, Dunstan Hill and Apex, as escort. If the refugees were sent on to Cyprus to the already crowded camps there, then the Jews would have won their point. 6,500 more Jews would have been taken out of Europe and added to the ever-growing numbers waiting on Cyprus to go to Palestine. The refugees from the so-called Promised Land, on the Empire Guardian, the Empire Renown, and the Magna Carta, are to be returned to their port of embarkation, Toulon, France. Henceforth, any other illegal blockade runners that are caught will also be returned to their ports of origin. The Palmachniks and Mossad Alia Bet people, who were with the refugees on the 3 ships, knew what they had to do. If they debarked and returned to Toulon, and if the British rode out the storm, then there would be no more illegal immigration. The order for secrecy went out in Toulon as the prison ships steamed into the Gulf of Lions and dropped anchor offshore. Simultaneously, the Palmach chiefs on each of the prison ships handed the British captains a message. Each one was to the effect that, "We will be taken ashore only by force." The commander of the prison ships radioed to the Admiralty in London for instructions. Whitehall immediately turned on the toughest diplomatic pressure they could, short of breaking the Anglo-French alliance. They warned the French not to attempt to take sides with the Jews and to allow the British to carry out the debarkation by force. For 4 days, messages and instructions flew between London and the prison ships and between Paris and London. Then the French government handed the British its dramatic decision. "The government of France will not allow or be a party to the forcible removal of the refugees. If the refugees desire to return to France of their own free will, they are most welcome. The French had taken a stand with the Jews, even at the risk of rupturing relations with the British. The refugees were exhilarated by the news. To a man, they renewed their vow to stay aboard the ships. The British, recovering from the shock, informed the refugees that they would either debark at Toulon or sit in the Gulf of Lions until they rotted. Aboard the Empire Guardian, Empire Renowned, and Magna Carta, the Jews dug in. The Palmachniks organized schools, taught Hebrew, compiled news, started a theater, and generally tried to keep things going. The French government kept up a daily stream of barges between the ships and Toulon to supply the refugees with good food and medical care. A dozen babies were born. At the end of a week, the refugees were holding fast. On shore, newsmen were getting curious about the three ships and were irate over the curtain of silence. One night, an Aliyah Bet man swam ashore from the Empire Guardian and gave out the full story to the French press. The story swept through France, Italy, Holland, and Denmark. Editorial insults were hurled at the British in all four countries. London braced itself against the onslaught of public resentment from the continent. They had expected it. They had, in fact, prepared for everything except the doggedness of the refugees. Conditions on the prison ships were of the worst. The atmosphere was sweltering, and there was a good deal of sickness. Nevertheless, the refugees refused to come ashore. The British crews, who did not dare venture into the caged sections of the ship, were beginning to get uneasy. At the end of the second week, the Jews were still holding fast, and the clamor in the press was reaching a crescendo. 3 weeks passed. 4 weeks passed. At last, the story began to lose its impetus. Then, the first Jew came ashore without being forced. He was dead. The whole issue was reignited. The captains of the three ships reported that the refugees seemed more determined than ever, and the pressure on Whitehall mounted hourly. If more corpses were brought ashore, it would be very bad. The policymakers decided to take another tack. They asked that the refugees send in delegations to talk it all over. Their plan was to try to find a compromise that might let them out of the whole affair without losing face. From all three ships, they received the same answer from the Palmach chiefs. We will settle for nothing more nor less than Palestine. The affair went into its sixth week. When the second corpse was brought ashore, the British issued an ultimatum to the Jews either to come ashore or suffer the consequences. It was not clear what those consequences were to be, but when the refugees again remained steadfast, the British had to take direct action. The Empire Guardian and the Empire Renown will set sail from Toulon at once. The destination of these two ships will be Hamburg, Germany, in the British occupation zone. The inmates of these two ships will be removed peacefully or otherwise and be detained at Dachau until further notice. As the two ships passed through the Straits of Gibraltar on the journey toward Germany, Mossad Aliyah Bet made feverish plans to load up two more ships with 15,000 refugees and make a run for Palestine. For as the Renown and Guardian landed on German soil, world opinion against the British reached a tidal peak. It was a somber victory for the Aliyah Bet. As a last face-saving gesture, the British let the third prison ship, Magna Carta, discharge its refugees at Cyprus, where they were sent to Carolus. Dov Landau was fortunate to pass his 16th year at Carolus rather than Dachau. But the boy was a study of hate. Chapter 28. Dov Landau spent his 17th birthday in yet another prison, Carolus. He ushered in this birthday as he ushered in every day. He lay on his cot and stared at nothing, and spent the day without uttering a word. He had not spoken to anyone since he had been dragged from the hold of the Promised Land. During the long weeks in Toulon Harbor, his hatred had grown. At Karaolos, a dozen welfare people and doctors and teachers and pamakniks tried to reach him and break through his wall of bitterness. But Dov trusted no one and wanted no one near him. By day, he lay on his cot. By night, he fought off sleep, for sleep always brought the recurring dream of that moment the doors of the gas chambers opened at Auschwitz. For hours on end, Dov would stare at the blue tattooed numbers on his left forearm. 359-195. Across the path from his tent, there lived a girl. And she was the most beautiful girl he ever remembered seeing. Of course, women could not be beautiful in the places he had been. She was in charge of many younger children, and she always smiled when she saw him, and she did not seem angry and aloof toward him as everyone else did. She was Karen Hansen Clement. Karen saw Dov and made inquiries as to why he did not take part in school and other activities. She was warned to keep away from him, for he was said to be an incurable, and maybe even dangerous. Karen took this as a challenge. She knew Dov had been in Auschwitz, and her compassion seemed limitless. She had done amazing things with youngsters before, and although she knew it might be better to leave Dov alone, her curiosity grew each time she went to her tent and looked over at his. One day, Dov lay on his cot, staring, and the sweat poured from him, for it was very hot. He felt someone's presence and jumped up instinctively and tensed at the sight of Karen standing near him.
"I wonder if I could borrow your water bucket. Mine has a leak, and the water trucks will be coming soon."
Dov stared and blinked his eyes nervously.
"I said, I wonder if I could borrow your water bucket."
Dov grunted.
"What does that mean? Yes or no? Can you talk?"
They stood and looked at each other like a pair of gamecocks. For that instant, Karen was sorry she had come. She took a deep breath.
"My name is Karen," she said. "I am your neighbor."
Dov still did not answer. He glared.
"Well, may I use your bucket or not? Did you come here to slobber over me?" "I came here to borrow your bucket. You are certainly nothing to slobber over," she snapped.
He spun away and sat on the edge of his cot and chewed his fingernails. Her abruptness disarmed him completely. He pointed to his bucket on the floor, and she picked it up. He glanced at her quickly out of the corner of his eye.
"What is your name? I'd like to be able to call you something when I bring your bucket back."
He did not answer.
"Well?" "Dov. Karen is mine. Perhaps you can call me that and we can say hello. At least till you learn to smile."
He turned very slowly, but she was gone. He walked to the tent door and watched her moving toward the British water tanker, which had just passed through the gate. She was beautiful. It was the first time in many months that an outside event had been able to penetrate Dov Landau's absorption in himself. This Karen was completely different from the others who had come to see him. She was abrupt and snippy and afraid. Yet there was a tenderness that radiated from her, too. She did not gush over him or recite words she didn't feel. She was a prisoner at Karaolos, but she did not complain or seem angry like all the others. Her voice was sweet, yet it was very stern.
"Good morning, Dov," Karen said. "Thank you for the use of your bucket."
He grumbled.
"Oh, yes. You are the one who growls instead of talking. I have a little boy like you in my kindergarten class, but he pretends he is a lion."
"Good morning!"
Dov shouted at the top of his lungs. Dov knew what time she got up in the morning. He knew when she went to the wash racks and when she came and went from her classes. He slipped into her tent one day and looked around for her bucket and examined it. It had no hole in it at all. He would lie on his cot all day and wait anxiously for the sound of her footsteps coming down the catwalk. He would sneak to the tent door and steal a glance in her direction. Often, Karen would glance at his tent, too, and their eyes would meet for a brief instant. Then Dov would become angry with himself for being taken in and for showing weakness. The days passed, but they were different now. He was still silent and sullen, but often his thoughts veered from death and hate, and he could hear the children in the playground nearby, and he could hear her voice speaking to them. It seemed strange to Dov. In all the time he was at Carolus, he had never heard the children playing until after he met her. One night, Dov stood by the barbed wire and watched the searchlights sweep through the tents. He often stood and looked, for he still did not want to sleep. On the playground, the Palmach had built a campfire, and there was singing and dancing. Once he used to sing and dance those songs at Redeemer meetings, but he did not want to hear them now. Mundek and Ruth and Rebecca had always been there.
Hello, Dov.
He whirled around and saw the dim outline of Karen standing near him. Her long hair blew in the breeze, and she tightened a ragged shawl about her shoulders.
Would you like to come to the campfire with me?
She pressed closer and he turned his back.
You like me, don't you? You can talk to me. Why don't you go to school and join our gang?
He shook his head.
Dov, she whispered.
He spun around and faced her, watery-eyed.
Poor Dov, he screamed. Poor crazy Dov. You're just like all the rest of them. You just talk prettier.
Dov grabbed her and put his hands on her neck and tightened his fingers on her throat.
You leave me alone! You leave me alone!
Karen looked him straight in the eye.
Take your hands off my throat this instant.
He dropped his hands.
I was only trying to scare you, he said. I wasn't going to hurt you. Well, you didn't scare me,
she said, and walked off. For a week after that, Karen did not look at him or speak to him. He was seized with terrible restlessness. Dov was no longer able to spend the hours in sullen and morbid silence. He paced back and forth all day long. Why did he let the girl break into his thoughts? He had his memories, and he had been alone with them. Now he could not think. One evening, Karen was on the playground when one of her children fell in a game and started to cry. She knelt beside him and put her arms about him and soothed away the boy's tears. For some reason, she looked up and saw Dov standing over her.
Hello,
he said very quickly, and walked away. Despite the continued warnings of many to leave him alone, Karen knew she had penetrated a great darkness. She knew the boy was desperate and trying to communicate, and that his hello was his way of saying he was sorry. A few evenings later, she found a drawing on her bed. She held it to the candlelight and saw a picture of a girl kneeling and holding a child, and barbed wire was beyond her. She crossed the path to Dove's tent, and when he saw her, he turned his back.
You are a very good artist, Karen said.
I ought to be, he snapped. I got plenty of practice. George Washington and Lincoln are specialties of mine.
He sat on his cot uncomfortably and bit his lip. Karen sat beside him. He felt funny, for he had never been so close to a girl other than his sisters before. Her finger touched the blue tattoo on his left arm.
Auschwitz? Why do you bother with me? Did you ever think that I might like you?
Like me?
Uh-huh. You are very good-looking when you aren't sneering, which is quite seldom, I must admit. And you have a very nice voice when you aren't growling.
His lips trembled.
I like you. You're not like the rest of them. You understand me. My brother Mundek used to understand me. How old are you? 17.
Dove sprang to his feet and whirled around.
I hate these goddamn British. They're no better than the Germans. Dove!
His sudden explosion ended as quickly as it had started. Yet it was a beginning. He had blown off steam. It was the first time in well over a year that he had spoken more than one or two words. Karen watched him shrink back into that strange, dark world of his. Dove wanted to see Karen often because she was tender and she could listen to him and understand. He would talk quietly for a while and then burst forth with an impulsive short tirade of hate, and then he would withdraw into himself. Karen began to confide in him and tell him about how she was going to meet her father again in Palestine. Since she had left the Hansons, she had always worked so long and hard with the youngsters, she had never really formed a close friendship. Dove seemed proud that she would tell him all these things, and it was strange, but she rather enjoyed talking to him. And one day, a great thing happened. Dove Landau smiled again. When they spoke together, he wanted to talk about nice things to her. The way she spoke, about the Hansons, the Danes, the children she loved, about her hope of reunion with her father, made him want to be able to talk like that too. But he could remember nothing nice. And before the war, 1939, was so long ago he could remember nothing about it at all. Karen was careful with subjects that Dove did not mention. She never asked about Auschwitz or the ghetto. After several weeks, she came to him one day with a mission.
Dove, I have a favor to ask.
Immediately, Dove turned suspicious.
The Mossad people know you were in Auschwitz, and they have also found out that you are an expert counterfeiter.
So?
There is a new man here from Palestine. Yoav Yarkoni tells me he wants to talk to you. His name is Ari Ben Kanan. He needs passports and documents and could use your services.
So that's it. That's why you made friends, so you could get me to work.
Oh, shut up, Dove. You don't even believe that yourself.
Well, Dove grumbled, if they want me so badly, they can come and ask me themselves.
How can anyone ask you anything when you won't even talk to them?
And why should I work for them?
Because they're working for you.
Hell, they are. They are working to save themselves.
All right. Take your side of it. They are no worse than the Germans, and if you could make American dollars for them, you can certainly make passports for the Mossad.
You're always so damned smart with the answers.
Dove, I've never asked a favor of you. What shall I tell them?
Tell them I might, but a lot of things have to be made clear.
Karen took his hand and smiled.
Why don't you make them clear? Ben Kanan is waiting for you.
I'll see him here.
Dove secretly liked Ari Ben Kanan. He was direct and to the point, and let Dove know that if he didn't work, he was going to be the last Jew out of Karolos. But more, Dove liked that quality of leadership in the man, the same quality Mundek had had. He went to work in the Palmach headquarters in one of the schoolrooms. Still, to everyone else in Karaolos but Karen, Dov Landau was incorrigible. He spoke only in anger. She was always called upon to calm his sudden eruptions. She saw in him things that no other person saw, wonderful strength and pride. There were other things that she could not explain that made her like him very much. 2.5 weeks after Ben Kanan's arrival on Cyprus, David Ben-Ami gave Dove a list of 300 names of children to be fixed on documents resembling British transfer orders. The 300 were supposed to be moved from Carolos to the new compounds near Larnaca. Dove knew that this was the escape. Neither his name nor the name of Karen was on the list of transferees. Dove told David that he wanted to speak to Ben Canaan, and it was then that he put his demands to Ari that he and Karen be included in the escape. And Ari agreed to his demands. Chapter 29. The final steps in Operation Gideon were 24 hours away. Ari Ben Canaan called a meeting of his chiefs in the home of Mandria, their Cypriot compatriot. David Ben-Ami gave Ari the transfer papers that Dov Landau had just completed. Ari looked them over and commented that the boy was a real artist. The papers could have fooled anyone. David reported that he had taken care of the 100 odds and ends, from security to putting kosher food on the ship for Orthodox children. Yoav Yarkoni, the Moroccan, reported that all the trucks were in ready condition and could be moved from the 23rd transportation camp to Carolos in 20 minutes. He gave the elapsed time of trial runs from Carolos to Kyrenia by several alternate routes. Zev Gilboa said that the 302 children would be loaded on the lorries in a matter of minutes after the convoy arrived at Carolos. He would brief the children as to what was going to happen a few minutes before the trucks departed. Hank Schlossberg, the American skipper of the Exodus, said he would take the ship out of its Larnaca berth at dawn and steam up to Kyrenia and be there at least a full hour or two before the convoy was due to arrive. Mandria reported that he had a system of lookouts posted along the escape route who could notify the convoy of any unusual British activity. He also had watchmen on a half-dozen alternate routes. Mandria said that he would wait, as ordered, in Famagusta in his home. The minute the convoy passed through, he would telephone Mark Parker in Kyrenia. Ari rose and looked over his lieutenants. They were nervous, all of them. Even the usually placid Yarkoni was looking at the floor. Ari did not congratulate them or wish them luck. There was time for congratulations. As for luck, they'd make their own. I did not want to make the escape for 3 more days until the British themselves began moving children from the children's compound. Nevertheless, we have received information that Major Alastair is suspicious of our activities. We even have reason to believe he has gone to London for instructions over Brigadier Sutherland's head. Therefore, we must make our break at once. Our trucks arrive at Carolos at 9 o'clock. By 10 o'clock, I hope we have loaded the children and are passing your house here in Famagusta. The minute we turn off the Larnaca Road, we have 2 crucial hours. We have no reason to believe our convoy will be stopped. Our trucks are well known all over Cyprus. But we must act under the assumption that we are under suspicion. Any further questions? David Ben-Ami, the sentimentalist, could not let the occasion pass without proposing a toast. Ari tolerated the younger man's frivolity.
L'chaim,
David said, raising his glass.
L'chaim,
the rest of them answered.
I have heard that l'chaim from you boys often,
Mandria said.
What does it mean?
It means to life, David answered. And to Jews, that is no small request.
To life, Mandria repeated. That is nice.
Ari walked up to Mandria and hugged him in the Palmach manner.
You have been a friend, he said. I must go meet Parker now.
Mandria stood there, with tears streaming down his cheeks, for he knew that this kind of affection was reserved for one of their own, and to receive it from Ari Ben Canaan meant that he had been accepted fully as one of them. A half hour later, Ari, dressed as Captain Caleb Moore, met Mark on the terrace of the King George Hotel. Mark was a bundle of nerves. Ari seated himself, refused a cigarette, and ordered a drink. Well? Mark asked impatiently.
Tomorrow. We will be at Garaola's at 9.
I thought you were going to wait until the British started cleaning out the children's compound.
It would have been better, but we can't wait. A friend at CID tells us that Alistair is onto something.
But relax, Ari said. It is almost over. The British still don't know what they're looking for.
Now you understand everything.
Mark nodded. He would send a cable asking for an extension of his vacation. Bradbury in London would know by the signature, Mark, that Operation Gideon had been a success and would turn loose the story Mark had sent with a commercial pilot a week earlier.
Suppose I don't get a phone call from Mondria at 10.
Ari smiled.
Then I'd suggest you get the hell off Cyprus, unless you want to cover my hanging.
That might be nice, Mark said. He finished his drink.
By the way, Ari said, looking out to the water, Kitty hasn't been in the camp since we were forced to put Karen on the Exodus list.
That's right. She's with me at the dome.
How is she?
How in hell do you think she is? She's miserable. She doesn't want Karen to go on the Exodus. Do you blame her?
I don't blame her, but I feel sorry for her.
That's nice. I didn't know you felt sorry for anyone.
I feel sorry that she has let her emotions get the best of her.
I forgot. You don't know anything about human emotions.
You're nervous, Mark.
Mark was angry at Ari's placidness. He remembered Kitty's anguish when she returned to Kyrenia and told him that Karen was going on the ship.
What do you want? Kitty has suffered more than one person has a right to suffer. Suffered?
Ari said.
I wonder if Kitty Fremont knows the meaning of the word.
Damn you, Ben Kanan! Damn you! What makes you think that Jews own a copyright on suffering?
Fortunately, you're not being paid to like me, and I couldn't care less.
How could you? You see, I like people with human weaknesses.
I never have them during working hours.
Mark stood up to leave. Ari grabbed Mark's arm in his powerful hand. For the first time, Mark saw Ben Kanan shaken from his complacency. There was anger in Ari's eyes.
What the hell do you think this is? A tea party on the Duchess's lawn? We're butting heads with the British Empire tomorrow.
He released his grip on Mark's arm and regretted the short display of temper. At that instant, Mark felt a tiny bit sorry for Ari. Perhaps he had a better way of disguising it, but the pressure was beginning to tell on him too. A few hours later, Mark had returned to the Dome Hotel in Kyrenia. He knocked on Kitty's door. She managed to greet him with a half-smile, but it could not disguise her red-rimmed eyes.
Tomorrow.
Kitty froze an instant.
So soon?
They're afraid the British are onto something. Kitty walked to the window and looked out at the pier and the island. It was a crystal-clear evening, and she could even see the faint outline of the Turkish coast.
I've been trying to get up enough courage to pack up and leave Cyprus.
Look, Mark said, as soon as this blows over, you and I are going to head for the Riviera for a few weeks.
To pick up the pieces? I thought you were supposed to go to Palestine.
I doubt if the British will let me in after this. Kitty, I feel pretty rotten about dragging you into this thing.
It isn't your fault, Mark.
You read that line well, but it's not quite true. Are you going to get over this?
Yes, I think so. I should have known better. You tried to warn me. At least I knew all the time that I was on thin ice. You know, Mark, it's funny, but we argued the night I met Ben Kanan. I told you there was something different about Jews. They aren't like us.
They have an unlimited capacity for getting into trouble. It's their favorite sport, Mark said, spinning off the bed and rubbing his temples.
Well, one way or the other, we might as well eat, and I'm hungry.
Kitty leaned against the door frame as Mark splashed his face with cold water. He groped for a towel. She handed him one.
Mark, it's going to be very dangerous on the Exodus, isn't it?
He hesitated a moment. There was no use trying to fool her at this point. It's a floating bomb. Kitty's heart sank.
Tell me the truth. Can they get away with this?
They have a fair chance with that mechanical monster Ari Ben Kanan running the show. The sun went down, and it was night. Mark and Kitty sat wordlessly in her room. No use sitting up all night, he said at last.
Don't go, Kitty said. I'll just stretch out over the covers.
She reached into the nightstand and took out a couple of sleeping pills, turned off the light, and lay back. Mark sat by the window and watched the surf slap against the shore. 20 minutes passed. He looked over at Kitty and saw she had fallen into a restless and thrashing sleep. He walked to the bed and stood over her for several moments, then covered her with a blanket and returned to the chair. At Karaolos, Dov and Karen sat on his cot, too excited to sleep. They spoke in whispers. They were the only ones among the children who knew what the new day would bring. Karen tried to calm Dov. He kept whispering what he was going to do when he got to Palestine, how he was going to join the terrorists and kill British soldiers. She hushed him up, as only she could, and finally induced him to lie down. As he closed his eyes, Karen stood up, and a strange sensation swept through her body, odd and frightening. Dov meant more to her than she had realized until this moment. First, it had been pity. Now, Dov had a hold on her. She did not understand it. She wanted to be able to go and talk it over with Kitty. But Kitty was gone.
Karen? I'm here, Dov.
The hours of darkness ticked by. At the 23rd Transportation Company, HMJFC, three men lay on their cots, wide-eyed. Zev Gilboa dared think about springtime in Galilee for the first time in nearly a year. He thought of his wife and child and of the farm. His baby had been only a few months old when the Palmach sent Zev to Cyprus. Yoav Yarkoni thought of his farm, too. It was different from Zev's, for it hugged the sea just a bit north of the plain of Sharon. His farm was called Stot Yam, and it meant fields of the sea, for its main crop was fish. Yarkoni loved to walk for hours through the abandoned ruins of Caesarea and dig for antiquities, and he hoped that the Palmach might let him return there for a while. He would go out on his trawler fishing, and he would see his brother and sister again. And David Ben-Ami thought of his beloved Jerusalem. He loved Jerusalem almost as much as he loved Ari's sister Jordana. Now he would see them both again, until they reassigned him to another mission. The rocky hills of Judea where his six brothers lived, and the city rose out of stone. David propped on an elbow and reread the worn letter that Ari had brought him.
Jordana. Jordana.
His heart raced wildly.
Jordana, my love.
The three men knew that their stay in Palestine might be brief because they belonged to the Palmach and Mossad, and they might be needed anywhere in the world. But this night, they thought of home. Brigadier Bruce Sutherland had another of his nightmares. He dressed and went out of his house alone and walked through Famagusta in the depth of night. He walked along the old wall of Famagusta and stared into the old city with its hundreds of churches and cathedrals and ruins of castles and memories of past glory. He walked until he came to Othello's tower, and he climbed it and looked down at the harbor. He was tired, very tired, and he wondered if there would ever be a night again in which he could close his eyes and fall into a peaceful sleep. Major J.J. Alastair fell asleep over his desk. Most of the night he continued to pore through reports and bits and scraps of information in an attempt to put together exactly what the Jews were up to at Karolos. Mandria paced back and forth in the room where the Mossad and Palmach had held so many meetings. Yes, it had been only a few weeks since Ari Ben Canaan and David Ben Ami had stood on that balcony outside and watched a convoy of Jews being taken from their illegal runner, Door of Hope. Tomorrow he would stand on the balcony, and another convoy would pass. This one would climax Ari Ben Canaan's fantastic scheme. The imagination of the Greek Cypriots had been tremendously stirred by the daring of the Mossad. Those of them, like Mandria, who worked with the Jews, were beginning to think in terms of an underground movement of their own against British rule on Cyprus. One man slept soundly. Ari Ben Canaan slept like a well-fed baby without a care in the world. A ray of light fell over Mark Parker's face. He opened his eyes and yawned. He had dropped off by the window with his feet propped on the sill. He was stiff, and his mouth tasted foul from cigarettes and scotch. He glanced around and saw Kitty in a deep and quiet slumber on the bed. He pulled the window shade down and tiptoed from the room, and shaved and spent several moments under an icy shower, and he felt better. He dressed and returned to Kitty's room and sat gently on the edge of her bed and stroked her hair softly. She stirred and opened her eyes slowly. She smiled when she saw Mark and stretched and purred. Then her expression changed to one of fear. At 9:20, Ari Ben Canaan, dressed as Captain Caleb Moore, entered the lead jeep in the convoy of 12 trucks of the 23rd Transportation Company. Each truck had a Palmachnik dressed like a British soldier as driver. They sped out of their camp and 20 minutes later halted before the administration building at Karaolos, outside the barbed wire compounds. Ari entered the administration building and knocked on the door of the commanding officer, whose acquaintance he had carefully made during the past 3 weeks.
"Good morning, sir," Ari said.
"Good morning, Captain Moore. What brings you up here?"
"We received a special dispatch from headquarters, sir. It seems that they are getting the Larnaca camp ready faster than they expected. They want me to transfer some children today."
Ari laid the forged papers on the officer's desk. The CO thumbed through the sheets.
"This isn't on the schedule of transfers," he said. "We didn't expect to start moving the children for 3 days."
"That's the army for you, sir," Ari said.
The CO bit his lip and meditated and stared at Ari, and looked through the transfer papers again. He reached for the phone.
"Hello? Potter here. Captain Moore has orders to move 300 children out of Compound 50. Dispatch a detail to help get them moved."
The CO picked up his pen and initialed the papers. He signed half a dozen other sheets authorizing entrance into the compound and removal of the children.
"Move them along, will you, Moore? We have another load to be transferred in an hour, and the roads could be clogged."
"Yes, sir."
Moore. Many thanks, old man, for the whiskey you sent up to the club."
"My pleasure, sir."
Ari gathered up the papers from the CO's desk. The CO sighed.
"Jews come and Jews go," he said.
"Yes, sir," Ari said. "They come and they go."
The breakfast table was set in front of the window in Mark's room. He and Kitty nibbled at their food. Mark's ashtray brimmed over.
"What time is it now?"
Kitty asked for the 15th time. "Almost 9:30.
"What would be happening?"
"If they're running on schedule, they're loading the children aboard the trucks right now." "Look," Mark said, pointing out to sea. The salvage trawler, Aphrodite Exodus, turned and moved slowly toward the harbor entrance.
"Good Lord," Kitty said. "Is that the Exodus?"
"That's her."
"My God, Mark. It looks like it's ready to fall apart."
"It is."
But how on earth are they going to get 300 children on her?
Mark lit another cigarette. He wanted to pace the room, but he did not wish to show Kitty how frightened he was. 9:30. 9:40. The Exodus passed between the lighthouse and the castle, through the narrow opening of the two arms of the seawall, and into the Kyrenia harbor. 9:50.
Mark, please sit down. You're making me nervous.
We should be getting a call from Mandria soon. Any minute now. Any minute. 10 o'clock. 5 past 10. 6 past 10. 7 past 10. Damn it! Where is that coffee I ordered? Kitty, phone from your room, will you? Tell them to get that coffee up here. 10:15. The fresh pot of coffee arrived. 10:17. Mark's jitters abated. He knew that if he did not hear from Mandria in the next 10 minutes, something had gone wrong. 10:20. The phone rang. Mark and Kitty looked at each other for an instant. Mark wiped the sweat from the palm of his hand, sucked in his breath, and lifted the receiver. Hello?
Mr. Parker.
Speaking.
Just a moment, sir. We have a call for you from Famagusta.
Hello? Hello? Hello?
Parker.
Speaking. Mandria here. Yes?
They have just passed through.
Mark replaced the receiver slowly. He got them out of Carolus, all right. They're moving down the road to Larnaca now. In about 15 minutes, they'll fork off and make a dash north. They've got about 50 miles, mostly flat country with only one mountain pass if they don't have to use alternate roads. They should be here a little after noon, if everything goes all right.
I'm almost hoping that something will go wrong,
Kitty said. Come on. No use waiting here. He took his field glasses and walked with Kitty downstairs to the reception desk and asked for a cable blank. Kenneth Bradbury, Chief, American News Syndicate, London. Having a ball. Request 2-week extension of my vacation. Advise. Mark. Send this through. Urgent. How long will it take? The receptionist read it over.
It will be in London in a few hours.
They walked from the dome toward the quay.
What was that about?
Kitty asked. My story should be on the wires from London tonight. They stood on the quay for several moments and watched the rickety salvage tug tie up at dockside. Mark led Kitty away. They crossed the harbor and climbed to the ramparts of the Virgin Castle. From here they could see both the harbor and far down the coastal road where the convoy was due to pass. At 11:15, Mark focused his field glasses on the coast road. He slowly scanned the road that hugged the shore and wove in and out of the hills. The mountain pass was too far off to see. He froze. He had sighted a tiny trail of dust and a line of trucks which appeared as small as ants. He nudged Kitty and handed her the glasses. She held them on the trucks as they wove in and out the snake-like turns and inched toward Kyrenia. They're about half an hour away. They came down from the rampart, crossed the harbor once again, and stood at the end of the quay, which was only 5 walking minutes from the Dome Hotel. As the convoy passed the hospital at the edge of town, Mark took Kitty's hand and started back to the hotel. In a phone booth at the Dome, Mark put in an urgent call to British intelligence in Famagusta.
I wish to speak to Major Alistair, Mark said, disguising his voice by putting a handkerchief over the mouthpiece and speaking with a British accent.
Who is calling, please? And what do you wish to speak to Major Alistair about?
Look, old boy, Mark said. 300 Jews have escaped from Caraolus. Now just don't ask any damn fool questions and give me Alistair.
The phone on Major Alistair's desk rang.
Alistair here?
He said in his whispery voice.
This is a friend, Mark said. I am advising you that several hundred Jews have broken out of Caraolus and are boarding a ship in the Kyrenia harbor at this very moment.
Alastair clicked the receiver several times.
Hello? Hello? Who is this? I say, hello?
He closed his own phone and opened it again.
Alastair here. I have a report of an escape of Jews. They are supposed to be boarding a ship at Kyrenia. Sound an alert. Blue. Have the Kyrenia area commander investigate at once. If the report is true, you'd better advise naval units to move for that area.
Alastair put down the receiver and rushed down the hall toward Sutherland's office. The convoy rolled to a stop on the quay. Ari Ben Canaan got out of the lead jeep and its driver drove it off. One by one, the lorries rolled up to the Exodus. The youngsters responded automatically as a result of Zeb's training. They moved quickly and quietly from the truck to the ship. On board, Yoav, David, and Hank Schlossberg, the captain, moved them into their places in the hold and on deck. The operation was effected calmly and wordlessly. Along the quay, a few curious onlookers stood and gaped. A few British soldiers shrugged and scratched their heads. As quickly as each truck was unloaded, it was driven off toward the mountains around St. Hilarion to be abandoned. As of that moment, the 23rd Transportation Company had fulfilled its purpose and was going out of existence. Yoav left a note in his truck thanking the British for the use of their lorry. Ari boarded the Exodus and went up to the wheelhouse. One by one, the lorries discharged the children. It took only 20 minutes to load the boat. Zev, David, Yoav, and Hank Schlossberg reported that the boarding had been completed. Ari gave the order to Hank, and he cast off and started the engines.
Get to the children, Ari said, and tell them exactly what we are doing and what will be expected of them. Any child who feels he cannot go through with it will advise me in the wheelhouse and he will be returned to Karaolos. Explain to them that their lives are in danger if they stay. There is to be no pressure from you or the children to induce others to remain who wish to go.
As the Palmachniks went down to brief the children, the Exodus backed into mid-harbor and dropped anchor. In an instant, the entire Kyrenia area was alive with the shriek of sirens. Ari turned a pair of field glasses on the hills and coastal road and saw dozens of British lorries and jeeps converging on Kyrenia. He laughed out loud as he saw the trucks of the late 23rd Transportation Company rushing up the hills to be abandoned. They were rushing away from Kyrenia and past the convoy of British soldiers coming in the opposite direction. Ari looked below him. The children on deck were calm. The British poured into the harbor area. Lorry after lorry of soldiers erupted onto the quay. Several officers were pointing at the Exodus and shouting orders. Soldiers began racing along both arms of the seawall and setting up machine guns and mortars at the narrow harbor opening, so that if the Exodus were to try, it could not get out to sea. More lorries poured into the area. The quay was roped off and curious spectators pushed back. Ari watched the British strength grow by the moment. Inside of an hour, the harbor was swarming with 500 fully armed soldiers. A pair of torpedo boats stationed themselves outside the harbor. On the horizon, Ari could see a trio of destroyers rushing to the scene. The sirens shrieked on. The peaceful little town was turning into an armed camp. Then tanks rumbled onto the quay, and artillery replaced the machine guns and mortars guarding the harbor entrance. Another blaze of sirens brought a car bearing Brigadier Sutherland, Caldwell, and Alastair onto the quay. Major Cook, the area commander of Kyrenia, reported to Sutherland.
That's the ship out there, sir. It's loaded with Jews, all right. It can't possibly get away.
Sutherland studied the harbor.
You've got enough here to fight a panzer division, he said. They must be insane on that boat. Get a public address system hooked up right away?
Yes, sir.
If you asked me, we'd blow them out of the water, Caldwell said.
I didn't ask you, Sutherland snapped.
Cook, get this area cordoned off. Organize a boarding party. Tear gas, small arms, in case they won't come back by themselves. Freddy, hop over to the dome and inform headquarters I want a news blackout.
Alastair had remained quiet and was studying the tugboat.
What do you make of it, Alastair?
I don't like it, sir, he said. They aren't pulling a daylight escape like this unless they have something else in mind.
Come now, Alistair. You're always looking for sinister plots.
Mark Parker pushed his way past the guards and approached the two officers. What's all the noise about? Mark asked Alistair. The instant Alistair saw Mark, he knew his suspicion was correct.
Really, Parker?
Alistair said.
Do be a good sport and tell us. You know, old man, you ought to brush up on your British accent the next time you telephone me.
I don't know what you're talking about, Major. Brigadier Sutherland was beginning to catch on. He looked from the tug to Parker and to Alistair, and he knew that the Mossad Alia Abed had caught him unprepared. He flushed. Major Cook, the Kyrenia area commander, reported,
We'll have boarding parties formed in 10 minutes, sir. 200 men, and we'll commandeer some trawlers here to take them out.
Sutherland did not even hear him.
Where is the loudspeaker, damn it all?
10 minutes later, Sutherland grabbed a microphone. A silence fell over the harbor. The boarding parties stood by to go out into the middle of the harbor after the exodus.
Hello out there. This is Brigadier Bruce Sutherland, the commander of Cyprus, speaking.
His voice shot out in a series of echoes.
Can you hear me out there?
In the wheelhouse of the exodus, Ari Ben Canaan opened his public address system.
Hello, Sutherland, he said. This is Captain Caleb Moore of the 23rd Transportation Company, His Majesty's Jewish Forces on Cyprus. You can find your lorries up at St. Hilarion.
Sutherland turned pale. Alistair's mouth dropped open.
Hello out there!
Sutherland's voice snapped angrily.
We are going to give you 10 minutes to return to Dockside. If you do not, we are going to send out a heavily armed boarding party and bring you back.
Hello, Sutherland. This is the Exodus speaking. We have 302 children aboard this boat. Our engine rooms are loaded with dynamite. If one of your troops sets foot on this boat, or if one round is fired from any of your guns, we are going to blow ourselves up.
At that instant, Mark Parker's story was being cabled from London to every corner of the world. Sutherland, Alistair, and the 500 British soldiers on the quay stood speechless as a flag was run up on the mast of the Exodus. It was a British Union Jack, and in its center was painted a huge Nazi swastika. The Battle of the Exodus was on. Chapter 30. Exclusive. David versus Goliath. Model 1946. By American News Syndicate correspondent Mark Parker. Kyrenia, Cyprus. ANS. I am writing this story from Kyrenia. It is a tiny, jewel-like harbor on the northern coast of the British Crown Colony of Cyprus. Cyprus has been rich in the pageantry of history. The island is filled with reminders of its vaunted past. From the ruins of Salamis to the cathedrals of Famagusta and Nicosia to the many castles of Crusader glory. But none of this colorful history can match, for sheer naked drama, the scene that is being played at this very moment in this quiet, unknown resort town. For some months, Cyprus has been a detention center for Jewish refugees who have tried to run the British blockade into Palestine. Today, 300 children between the ages of 10 and 17 escaped the British camp at Karaolos in an as yet undetermined manner, and fled across the island to Kyrenia, where a converted salvage tug of about 200 tons awaited them for a dash to Palestine. Almost all the escapees were graduates of German concentration and extermination camps. The salvage tug, fittingly renamed the Exodus, was discovered by British intelligence before it could get out of the harbor. With its 300 refugees, the ship is sitting at anchor in the center of the harbor, which measures a mere 300 yards in diameter, and has defied all British efforts to have the children debark and return to Karaolos. A spokesman for the Exodus has announced that the hold of the boat is filled with dynamite. The children have joined in a suicide pact, and they will blow up the boat if the British attempt to board her. London. General Sir Clarence Tever Brown dropped the copy of the newspaper on his desk. He lit a cigar and studied the reports. Mark Parker's story was creating a sensation not only in Europe, but in the United States. Tever Brown had a request for instructions from Sutherland, who refused to take the responsibility of issuing an order to board the Exodus. Tever Brown knew that part of the blame was his. He had chosen Bruce Sutherland for the job of commander himself, and he had failed to act on the letter from Alastair, which had warned that something was going to happen unless Sutherland was replaced. Humphrey Crawford entered Tever Brown's office. Crawford was a pasty-faced career man in the Middle East section of the Colonial Office, and served as liaison between the Army and the policymakers at Whitehall and Chatham House.
"Afternoon, Sir Clarence," Crawford said nervously. "It is time for our meeting with Bradshaw."
Tever Brown arose and gathered some papers together.
"Mustn't keep old Cecil Bradshaw waiting."
Cecil Bradshaw's office was in the Institute of International Relations at Chatham House. For 30 years he had been one of the top men in formulating British Middle East policy. At the end of World War I, Britain and France competed for influence in the Middle East. When the British got the Palestine Mandate, Bradshaw had been one of those, with Winston Churchill, who had pushed for the creation of an Arab state out of half the mandate. The state they were instrumental in forming was Transjordan. The entire purpose for bringing it into being was to turn it into a British military base. British subsidies made possible the establishment of Britain's Arab army, the Arab Legion, and the choosing of a king for Transjordan. He was the Hashemite Arab Abdullah, mortal enemy of Saud of Saudi Arabia. At the end of World War II, the Labour Party swept into power with promises, among others, to help establish a Jewish homeland in Palestine and a refuge for the survivors in